try your call again. If you need assistance, dial your operator. Please hang up now. This is a recording.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hello, Kyle, right here.
And out in Signal Land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
You do indeed. Good evening.
And we have Alex.
You do. Hello.
Well, sorry. If people could see what we go through to get on the air here, it's simply unbelievable. But we made it. That's the important thing. And programming note, next week we will be doing our call-in program here on WBAI, so get your telephones ready for that adventure. If you can't wait, we're on overtime tonight at 8 o'clock on YouTube on Channel 2600, and we take phone calls there as well. But it's not as much fun as when you call and you're on the radio. Interesting day today. Kind of a scary day, I think. I don't know if you guys have been following the news at all, but there was this hearing in Washington, D.C., and, I guess really the only way to sum it up is to play a brief excerpt of it. Would you like to hear a little bit of the hearing today?
Sure thing.
Right. Yes.
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
Yeah, that's Dr. Anthony Fauci testifying before a bunch of rabid Republicans who are basically, they've got the tiki torches out and everything. This guy would not give them anything. And, you know, it's interesting. He did this over 100 times. In fact, you can hear him kind of getting a little weaker.
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
That was about 50 times in. They want to put him in jail. They want to prosecute him for everything that happened with COVID, whether it is the origination of COVID, whether it's the restrictions that came about because of COVID. And many of these are people that do not believe in vaccinations, that believe... I don't know what they believe, to be honest, but they want a scapegoat. And I wanted to ask you, Alex, you know, when I saw this on the news this morning, it seemed bad. It just seems bad, I think, to the average person, which is all I am, when you see somebody constantly saying they're pleading the Fifth to protect themselves. It sounds like they're guilty of something. And Fauci did this over 100 times today. and the media, and including, you know, the so-called left media, is basically portraying it that way, like he was covering something up. And in actuality, it's a strategy to shut these people up, to shut them down, actually. Because they basically want this 85-year-old guy to slip up and say something that they can get him on and throw him in jail. Because I still don't know why they hate him so much. We can analyze this for hours and still not reach any kind of a conclusion. But I realize that was a tough strategy, but it was a smart strategy. And I'm wondering, Alex, do you think that was a good strategy to do that when you are facing a room full of people that are out for your neck and you have the Fifth Amendment? Do you use it in this way? Even if you're as innocent as the pure snow, you know, do you repeatedly... I mean, basically, they asked him, do you see this red book in front of you? And he took the Fifth on that as well. He would not give them anything. At one point, they threw his lawyer out of the room because they didn't like the way he was actually... Well, he wasn't allowed to speak, apparently, or even sit at the table. It was really, really scary to watch this. It really was, because you realize these people have power. They have a lot of power, and they have a lot of hatred, and they know how to manipulate people. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the Fifth Amendment, it's a powerful tool. It's kind of like a Leatherman, you know. It's like the all-in-one tool against self-incrimination in many ways. I don't think repeatedly invoking the Fifth Amendment is in and of itself inherently bad. It's probably the legally safest maneuver when somebody's testimony could create criminal exposure for that particular person, which, you know, in a room full of rabid senators looking to hang you out dry, it's definitely the legally safest move. So the downside to it, though, is that it looks evasive, it looks political, it looks very strategic, and it certainly invites suspicion. And I think in some contexts, in perhaps this one as well, though I didn't watch the hearing myself, I would imagine that it would trigger a fight over whether the privilege under the Fifth Amendment is actually available to Fauci, right? Because it protects a person from being forced to give testimony that would actually incriminate them, right? So the protection can be used question by question, but it can be abused as well. It can be overused. And so I think, you know, critics are certainly going to think that the witness is something to hide. Fauci has something to hide here. There's going to be social judgment. But that social judgment is not a legal conclusion. And legal judgment and legal liability is what the Fifth Amendment is supposed to shield people from with respect to self-incrimination. So I think Fauci did the right thing here, to be honest.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, am I correct in thinking basically there is nothing that he could have said that would have served him and not served the people out to get him? Like, they could have taken anything he said, manipulated it any which way, and so this was literally kind of the only choice he had, was to say, I'm not giving you anything, you're not going to do anything with this.
Yeah, you know, if he had answered a few questions with the Fifth and answered other questions, then I would have thought it was evasive. Then I would have thought he was trying to hide something. But when he wouldn't even answer that, you know, the red book was in front of him without saying he's taking the Fifth, it was basically a big middle finger to these people saying, I'm not giving you a damn thing, and I am not afraid of you. Gila.
And also to say that if he answered the questions, they would take all of his answers out of context. Mm-hmm. They would hold whatever answers he gave against him. If he didn't answer them, they would hold him in contempt of Congress. This was threading the needle, I think, very carefully.
Yeah. I've given depositions, and you become aware very quickly how you can be manipulated. If you make even a casual aside, like, boy, it sure was hot that day, you know, they will just keep driving until they get something out of you that is just slightly off or wrong or contradictory, and that's their job. That is what they are there to do. And it's kind of sickening to see this being done to a scientist, somebody who was doing the best they could at a very stressful time for everybody. And to expect somebody to know all the answers when nobody knew what was going on back in 2000, that's just, you know, it's just, you realize how incredibly petty these people are, and many of them are the same ones who were minimizing what COVID actually was. You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't accuse the guy of somehow being responsible for COVID. I mean, what are the odds that we've got the guy responsible for COVID right in that room? Something that you know, affected the entire world. But this is the guy. This guy and apparently all of China conspired. But also, he's guilty of overreacting to COVID by having our kids stay out of school and making us wear masks and not go to baseball games and things like that. So it, basically, they're throwing things at the wall, seeing what sticks, and it's a good warning to all of us, because we may very well all find ourselves in some kind of legal issues, legal troubles, where we have to face something like that. And this is a great demonstration for any law class, for any elementary school, I think, of what the Fifth Amendment is there to protect. It's there to protect you from a mob of people like we saw today sitting in the Senate chairs. Really, really scary. Rob?
And it's there's an amusing example of how far they'll go even when you don't give them anything. I'm looking at a piece on HuffPost where the headline in big imposing letters is "Body language experts reveal the key cues they spotted in Fauci's testimony." And so they're reading whatever they can into this and getting whatever signals they can out of this. You know, no spoilers if you haven't read the article yet. But they get an entire piece out of what they think he's saying with his body language. And it's, I'm actually a bit entertained by this while also feeling really bad for this guy.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they would do that, I mean, Huffington Post, aren't they one of the ones that are accused of, being left-leaning? And here they are trying to find the guy, find something on the guy just for saying the fifth over and over again. I mean, you know, to me, body language seemed a little pissed off, seemed a little impatient, didn't really want to be there. But it's just, I don't know, read the body language of the senators. That's where I think you'll really find something interesting. And the conversational tone of Dr. Rand Paul, who's trying to explain how medicine works, because, well, at least he's talking, at least he's explaining things to people, trying to, you know, connect to the American public as somebody they can identify with. And this guy, this evil scientist, he is the person that we have to string up someplace. I mean, it really was frightening to see. Go ahead, Alex.
I think the real fight here, or the real issue with respect to the Fifth Amendment, isn't whether he invoked it too many times, but as to whether he actually had the right to invoke it at all. Because don't forget, he did receive a preemptive presidential pardon because Biden knew that there was going to be obviously a witch hunt with respect to Fauci. So the pardon is where I think this can actually get really complicated from a Fifth Amendment perspective, because if he was subject to a valid federal pardon, that then arguably would have eliminated the risk of any criminal prosecution that could have arisen from his testimony today, or any criminal prosecution for the pardoned conduct that he received. And then that can really weaken his ability to invoke the Fifth Amendment privilege with respect to any questions that implicate that already pardoned conduct, because that means that he was not in jeopardy of any type of criminal prosecution through self-incrimination, and therefore the Fifth Amendment wouldn't necessarily apply in the context of somebody who's already pardoned for that criminal activity.
Okay.
That they could be investigated.
That might protect him against plotting and scheming with China to start COVID or whatever it is they're trying to accuse him of. But it wouldn't protect him against anything beyond January 2025 when he received the pardon. And that would include today anything he said that was contradictory or that could be said to be not the truth. And, you know, it's really easy to find somebody saying something that is not the truth. I bet I could find each of you here saying something not completely truthful in the next 45 minutes. It's not hard to do. And that, they would have gone after him. They would have imprisoned him. And that is why he pled the fifth every time.
Yeah, sure. But to be fair, if somebody's compelled to testify before Congress, you can't just take the fifth and decide not to testify, right? You have to have some kind of
apparently you
legal
can
jeopardy.
Because he did just that.
He did do just that, right? And so the issue, though, is about, you know, is he properly invoking the Fifth Amendment? Because he was pardoned. There was already a pardon, right? So if he wasn't facing any kind of criminal exposure, then arguably,
of course he was.
The Fifth Amendment
today
didn't apply.
He's facing criminal. Basically, they want to try him for something. They want to find something on him, and whatever he says
Amendment,
today, they will find something.
Right, but for those aspects over which he was questioned, for which a pardon already applies, it's hard to argue then that the Fifth Amendment would allow you to withhold any testimony if you are not incriminating yourself, because the Fifth Amendment only applies when you're going to incriminate yourself and put yourself in legal jeopardy.
They will find
so
something contradictory
pardoned.
In what he would have said today,
they
and then they would have accused him of lying in front of Congress. That's a crime. They would have found something, Alex. You know they would have.
But Emmanuel, if you or Rob or I or Gila or Kyle are compelled to go and testify in front of Congress or something, we have to give testimony. We can't just stonewall them and say Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Fifth Amendment when they're asking about the, you know, it's improper invocation. We can't just stonewall them and misuse the Fifth Amendment if there's no real legal jeopardy here. I mean, I think he's going to get away with it because it's very clear that the Republicans want to hang him out to dry. I mean, they want to. You know, they've been angling for this guy for so long that there is some potential for I would guess, a criminal investigation somewhere. But I do think that this pardon is going to complicate things, and I think we may see legal action related to it as well.
Go ahead, Rob.
Well, it's going to shake out in about a week. Rand Paul called for a vote, so the committee is going to vote Wednesday on the 5th. To see the fifth, actually, which is funny, to see if they want to hold him in contempt.
Well, I already hold them in contempt, and I can hardly wait to cast my vote. Hopefully we see some justice at some point against this craziness. I mean, think of all the things that these people are getting away with. Think of all the money that's being stolen, all the institutions that are being decimated. All the vandalism that's happening, all the fear that's being instilled, all the people that are being prosecuted for nothing, people being killed in the streets. At some point, there has to be justice for that. And this is nonsense to be even talking about this. But it is a very important civics lesson, and that's why, you know, we're devoting a few minutes to this. But there's another case. There's another case that I think is even closer to home as far as something involving the hacker community or just people that value freedom of speech and freedom in general. And that is the story of a U.S. citizen who was traveling and was basically stopped by Customs and Border Patrol in Atlanta for some reason. I guess maybe he was coming back into the country there. They asked or demanded that he enter his password into his phone so that they could basically look at everything in his phone, steal everything, you know, copy everything, whatever you want to call it. And he gave them a password, and the password wiped out every bit of data. That's what I've always wanted to do. I just don't have something like that. But now, you know, thanks to this story, I know a lot more about how to get this. So federal prosecutors in Atlanta are bringing an obstruction charge against a U.S. citizen who gave customs officers what is known as a duress passcode. That activated software that erased the contents of his phone. Samuel Tunick is an Atlanta resident. He was stopped for interrogation at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport as he returned to the United States. On January 24th of last year, I don't know why we're finding out about this now, but it's made all the news now. But, yeah, it was over a year ago. And this is according to a November grand jury indictment that we're also just finding out about. The authorities seized his phone before allowing him to enter the country. A hearing on the case was held last week in federal court in Atlanta, and I guess that's when everything became public. The prosecution is one of the earliest known instances of federal authorities charging a person with destroying evidence with a program designed to wipe a device when a specific code is entered. His lawyers argued during the hearing that the seizure was unlawful, that he was targeted because of his political activism against Atlanta's plan to build a police and fire training center within a 1,000-acre stretch of urban woodland. Opponents argue that the center, known as Cop City, would militarize officers and destroy precious green space. The federal statute underlying the charge makes it a felony to destroy evidence or transfer assets to keep the government from seizing them, or to tip someone off about an upcoming search or wiretap. It carries a penalty of up to 5 years in federal prison, a fine, or both. The act applies before, during, or after a search if the target of an investigation knows that a search or seizure is imminent and that person acts to thwart it. He or she would fall under the statute, according to experts. The Federal Public Defender's Office, which handles most cases in the Northern District of Georgia, said that only one other federal indictment had been filed on this charge in the last 30 years. The 2019 case involved an accusation of destruction of evidence related to drug trafficking. And, you know, that's kind of a difference right there, because you're pointing to something. You're pointing to a crime. Drug trafficking, that's a crime. Here, the crime is protecting one's privacy and refusing to allow these authorities, quote-unquote, to grab your phone and just read whatever they feel like reading off of it, even when it's password protected. And when you don't give them the password or you give them another password, they asked for a password. He gave them a password, so I don't know what the problem is. But he basically protected his own interests, as I believe he has every right to do. Kyle.
Yeah, and I question the validity of it in that the obstruction charge for something where you don't have credible evidence or probable cause, like there's that a crime itself is taking place, this sort of random screening thing that they're trying to condition people to accept, seems to be in a limbo, because you have a right to your personal effects. And I think it would a counter poised to it would be that it's instructing his ability to freely assemble and organize and register grievances of their own regarding this project of public interest. So it doesn't seem like they're really, I mean, obstructing what crime or what with what evidence did they have that he couldn't protect himself because he had his own inherent rights under the assumption that he's innocent until proven otherwise.
Well, I think their argument would be that he ruined the whole thing because now they can't prove the crime.
Right, and the other part of it is
they were looking forward to that, and he just ruined it.
The other part of it is it's such a catch-all for so much information. It's not like a subpoena or something, or like something that's a specific piece of information that you would get, like in some of the cases we've talked about with metadata and other parts of people's personal identifiable information. This is like a comprehensive store of things in every facet of someone's life: personal conversations, contacts, phone calls, banking, any kind of web traffic, all of that, and it itself may grant them far too much access, especially when you don't have an actual crime or an actual transgression that would warrant the authority that they're trying to wield. Does that make sense? Am I wrong in any part of that?
Well,
I'm sure I'll be told.
No, to me it makes sense. It makes sense.
That's
because
my attitude. It gets even more protective.
Well, I'm looking at it from an individualistic point of view. Now, if you look at it from law enforcement's point of view, they want to pursue their case. And when you get in the way of that, you're the problem. What they fail to understand is that individuals have their own interests, and they wish to protect themselves, and they have the right to protect themselves. Now, I know a lot of people are saying, well, this guy violated the law because they're entitled to look at your phone. And that's where I differ. I don't think they're entitled to look at my phone or anyone's phone. You know, if
I commit a crime while I'm standing in line, yeah. Or if they have, like, a warrant out, maybe.
Here's how I think it should work. Somebody is arrested, or they have their house seized or whatever, and they go nuts and they take everything, you know, as they do. And I guess, you know, even though I wouldn't necessarily enjoy it, they have the stuff in their possession. They can do whatever they want with it because they have it in their possession. But if you want to walk up to me and say, hey, Emmanuel, give me your phone, tell me your password, give me all your secrets, and I don't keep my secrets on my phone anyway, but the point is, they expect me to just cooperate with them. Why? Because they're law enforcement and I have to do everything they say. And I say, hell no. No, I don't have to do what you say. And if I have the opportunity, I will destroy my private material so that you don't get to see it. And if I'm a criminal, find another way to prove I'm a criminal without doing that. Alex, refute everything I just said. Go ahead.
Yeah.
In one breath. One breath.
Yeah, in one breath. Let me take a deep breath here. Okay, where to start now? Okay, so I think this is an incredibly fascinating case, and I think we could spend hours and hours talking about it, and I think we should. You know, there's a crazy hacker conference coming up in New York where I think, you know, it would be a great place to have an extended debate about this thing. But while we're here on the air, I think really what this boils down to is this Graphene OS wipe feature. Right? Is it a privacy feature or is it obstruction of justice? And it depends on the context. And I think to a certain extent, you're right, Emmanuel. But to a certain extent, I also think you're wrong about it, too, because what this really hinges on is whether there was a lawful search happening here, right? So I think, on the one hand, if you think about this from the government's perspective, they do have a very plausible anti-spoliation theory, and spoliation being the word for destruction of evidence. That's kind of the legal term of art. When you spoliate evidence, it's destruction of evidence, something that could have been used against you. So if a traveler at a border stop, if he deliberately triggers a wipe during what is a lawful inspection, then that begins to look like intentional interference with lawful seizure there, right? So I think there's a real policy concern because authorities don't want somebody who's a device owner, a traveler, to just nullify evidence the moment that a lawful stop happens. But on the other side of this, the user side, the privacy side, I think there's a arguably more plausible civil liberties invoking theory here, because border agents already have such an expansive amount of authority and an ability to inspect and seize at the border. So device search rights there are already weak. They're already ambiguous. So users do need something to protect themselves, to protect their own sensitive data from the coercive access of the state itself. And if the state, remember, we're talking about the state, we're talking about the federal government here. If the state can punish a person, an individual person, for using a built-in privacy setting on a phone in an operating system, then what's the practical value of any encryption-based self-defense? There's none at that point. The precedential effect of this case could be really, really far-ranging. And where I think I'll stop there, but because there's a technical aspect of this I want to jump into, but let's stay on the policy side.
Well, I want to talk about Graphene OS a little bit later as well, because it's really something fascinating I think a lot of our listeners would be interested in. But I just wanted to bring up a hypothetical here. If this guy was on a plane, right, and he learned that they're checking everybody who lands in Atlanta, and he erased his phone then, is that the same crime in these people's eyes? If he just felt paranoid and erased it at some point? I mean, keep in mind, he's using a phone's feature. he has this particular OS on his phone by choice, and that's what it's designed to do, and he's simply using it. And by erasing it, he no longer has access to it. Now, if he's a criminal, he's going to need access to his basic crime tools, whatever is on his phone, and he's going to have to do something to get them back, and maybe that's where you get him if he really is a criminal. Rob had something, then we'll go back to Alex. Rob.
Yeah, an interesting thing about this story hitting the mainstream like this is more and more people are becoming aware of the concept of a duress PIN or a duress password. And that's something that I think most people might be aware of as a feature of security alarms, burglar alarms, things of that sort. The idea being that there's a code you use to really disable it, but there's also a code you can use if, say, a dangerous person is ordering you to disable it, and instead this code makes it look like it's disabled but still calls the police and whatnot. So the idea of a duress password, which is supported in Graphene OS, it's not a feature of Android off the shelf, but this particular security-focused version of Android that you can choose to put on certain phones supports it as a feature, and I think it's a great feature. And it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out in court.
Yes, Alex.
Well, this feature, I think, is or really should be front and center, because what actually happened when the duress password was entered is kind of fascinating. And I think we really should unpack it a bit here on the show, given that we are a hacker show here, right? Because arguably, none of his data was deleted. Nothing was deleted, okay? Per Graphene OS's own change logs from June 2024, the mechanism used in Graphene OS for the associated with the entrance of the duress password is that it doesn't delete the data from the device itself, but what it does is it wipes all of the hardware key store keys, including the keys that are used to derive the key encryption keys for disk encryption. So when you delete all of those keys, you cannot decrypt the data, and makes all of the OS data on the disk itself unrecoverable. Then it wipes the eSIMs, and then it shuts down. So there's actually no overwriting of the user data in that disk partition at all. Presumably, all of the ciphertext blocks, the encrypted data on the drive, are still sitting there on the drive. There's nothing gone. What's gone are the keys. What's gone is the ability to decrypt the data. He didn't delete anything. He just deleted the keys.
Well, they would say the keys are what they needed to look at everything else.
They're what they needed, but it's not the data itself.
And is there a chance those keys are backed up someplace else?
No, I don't think so. And I think that the way Graphene did it was to securely overwrite those keys many times, I would presume, to make them unrecoverable.
See, what I don't get is, what do they think they had on this guy that they could only get from his phone? Keep in mind, he is deleting, whatever word you want to use, getting rid of that particular bit of information. He no longer has access to it either. So it can't be something that is vital to whatever plan he's engaged in. The fact that they knew something was on his phone and knew that his making it inaccessible to them somehow furthered his evil plot, it just sounds really, really shaky to me.
Well, think about it from this perspective, right? I mean, they were compelling him to enter some kind of passcode to decrypt the data that was on his phone. So we can bring this right back again to the Fifth Amendment here, right? And I think there's a good structural reason to do it, because it would have been a spoken passcode. So the government's case here would essentially rest on something that was a verbal communication that was extracted during a government interrogation. That squarely puts the Fifth Amendment at the center of this particular dispute as well. And as I understand it, this individual's legal team actually moved to suppress the interrogation and the phone evidence on both the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment as well. So I think, you know, we're kind of going full circle here, because the Fifth Amendment may be front and center and decide this particular legal dispute as well.
It seems like the same basic thing that we were talking about before with Anthony Fauci, that basically you have the right to keep quiet. If you don't want to talk to the people that are trying to trip you up in one way or another, You don't have to. You have the right to keep quiet. And in both of these cases, that's what the people were trying to do, not give anything to the authorities. Again, you know, if the authorities have something on you, well, use that. Use that. You don't need to have the subject of your investigation incriminate themselves further if you already have something. It might not be everything you want, but it's got to be enough to get you somewhere. And if it's not, maybe you don't have much to start with. I don't know. People have the right to defend themselves. I keep hearing that all the time. Except when people like us decide to do it, all of a sudden it becomes illegal and, you know, against the rules. Well, it's great when you make the rules such that you have to comply and basically give away your secrets just because they demand your secrets. If he hadn't given them a password at all, they would have charged him with something else, you know, not giving up, and they would have brute forced his phone until they figured something out or until it destroyed itself. I don't know what happens if you keep guessing and don't get somewhere. So it just seems like the system is set up so that people trying to protect themselves are considered criminals. And I think that's very unhealthy.
It also speaks to kind of this one piece of conventional wisdom, I think, among IT hacker tech-focused people when traveling, which is it's usually a good idea to, when you're bringing devices across the border, computers, laptops, phones, whatever, to basically clear them of anything that you wouldn't want to share before you make the trip. Any important data you have while you're over there, upload it back home over the internet, get rid of it off your device, and fly home with a laptop or a phone or whatever else that doesn't have anything important on it, because you know, at the border they can use whatever means they have at their disposal to look at whatever they want here.
Go ahead, Alex.
This one, I think we're going to have to really be watching closely here too. The ramifications are long term. I can see this issue very easily going up on appeal to the circuit courts, possibly even to the Supreme Court in a few years. Who knows? But what's clear, though, is if the government wins this, it's going to certainly chill coercion-resistant security tools. And we need coercion-resistant security tools. We need things that protect our personal data from governmental overreach. We see it all the time. We need it. We need it for journalists. We need it for human rights defenders. We need it for ordinary citizens crossing the border these days. I mean, it's just the way of the world. And if the defense wins this one, well, then border agents are definitely going to be pushed towards, I think, more narrow and more specific demands for seizures. It will undercut their rights at the border. They'll have to have clearer warrants. And make, I think, very specific demands before actually having access or getting access to an individual's device. And I see that as a good thing. I see pushing back on the government's authority at the border as certainly something that's a long time overdue.
Yeah, I would just stick to, like, basic stuff. I think that getting into, like, all of the personal data and, like, information stuff is sort of beyond the scope of their duties there. They're looking for very specific things upon entry into the country. And I don't think that we should be, like, feeling like a secret agent every time we, like, get on a plane and want to go travel or want to go see our friends or do something. It's to me just absurd, and that whole rule about, you know, rule of thumb about you know, preparing to travel, I think it just adds too much paranoia and too much stress to an already stressful experience. I mean, especially in air travel. So I have a lot of problems with that, and I think that that we'd live in a society that we'd have to prepare, where we have to prepare that much. And it should not be the case. We really open ourselves up. And I think, as was pointed out, there are many different types of people crossing the border, that there are classes and categories of individuals that need protection. And you're opening up way too much more liability in an already really fraught data security environment when you've got, you know, millions of travelers, all these sorts of devices being, what, copied and, what, stored with the federal government somewhere. How much in the business, how many in the business and finance and other service industries and communities that rely on business intelligence and their own intellectual property, how much of that stuff is going to be compromised and stored and then maybe, you know, leaked or held captive in a malware campaign by from some negligence by a third party? I mean, we see this stuff over and over and over again. And so I just really am skeptical of the utility of trying to implement this stuff when you're already, like, you know, throwing non-ionizing radiation at people and running them through hell and with passable coffee. I mean, we deserve better as a society, and I just can't stand it. And I think, and on into journalists and activists, people exercising their rights in as a practitioner of it myself, and people that across different fields, I think, really just deserve better from our government, and it should be manifest in people's outcry.
Yeah, and it goes back, Kyle, I think, really, you know, to this Fifth Amendment, right? This issue of it being this kind of Leatherman all-purpose tool against self-incrimination here. And I think there's a real trade-off here, and it's so clear with this case, right? Because it depends on your viewpoint. Because, as you mentioned, you know, there are people that are at real risk of coercion from our government, from other governments, not just ours, not just the United States, you know, traveling over into, who knows, traveling into Iran, traveling into Russia. There are international issues here, and so many people facing coercion, but the very existence and implementation of something like a duress passcode could itself end up, as it is in this case, looking like some kind of legal signal or some kind of indication of intent that the user anticipated some form of conflict with the authorities or some kind of search to occur with respect to their devices. So in a sense, just using it, using the feature, makes you look guilty.
So protecting yourself is considered intent.
That's the problem here. That's the trade-off. It could look like that, and that would be that's a horrible thing to have happen.
Well, that's the road we're going down.
It's the same fallacy that encryption, you know, if you're encrypting, you have something to hide. No, the normalizing of it and the ubiquity of it on websites, on communications, was the norm. We just weren't doing it as a practice.
Yeah,
and look, so on one hand, a feature that can improve confidentiality can also drastically, I think, alter and worsen the optics that are involved with respect to your intent to either destroy your data or to obstruct justice here. It's, you know, it goes back at root to it. Is this a privacy-enhancing feature?
I have a couple of hypotheticals, but let's let Rob speak first, and then I'll get to my fun hypotheticals here.
Yeah, I think in the case of this guy, if instead of giving his duress password to the authorities and having them enter it and having the phone be cleared that way, if instead he made this part of his normal routine to just clear his stuff while he was in the air, while he was traveling, before he got home and said, oh, this is my normal routine, that could possibly be, I believe, a defense against trying to say, well, you knew we were going to search you, so you purposely, willfully clear out your stuff. If it's just something you automatically do as part of your data hygiene practices, I think that might be more defensible. Do you think so, Alex?
Yeah, I do. I definitely do. Yeah, I mean, if it's more of like a routine thing, as you're suggesting, like you must have like some kind of policy that you're simply implementing, doing this on a daily or routine basis. Sure.
So my theory is that the data that was actually on there is negligible, that there is nothing on there, and that this was just somebody knowing that they were going to be challenged and messing with them, as they have every right to do, as they should do. And I think, you know, that would still be considered in their eyes a crime for some reason. You're not covering up evidence, but you're wasting their time. But they're wasting their own time by pursuing this in the first place. Now, the hypothetical I want to pose, supposing there was data on that phone, supposing it was a plot, a terrorist plot, supposing you you managed to work with artificial intelligence to shape the plot so that it fits you, you know, it fits your life, your habits, your locations, all that kind of thing. So to anybody reading it, it would seem believable, but it's all fake. And it's all protected behind a password. And these idiots come and demand your password, and you tell them the password, and then they find this whole big fake fiction story. Is that a crime? I mean, you're basically plotting terrorism that's not going to happen. And people have been charged for coming up with harebrained schemes that didn't stand a chance in hell of working. But in this particular case, they literally asked for it. And you followed their rules and provided it to them, and they're not happy with what they're reading. What if you don't explain what's on the phone? What if, you know, you make them waste even more time? There's all kinds of ways this can go.
Yeah, I mean, I would think they would be angry if you had some kind of fictional terrorist plot on your phone that they uncovered. It probably wouldn't be the best way to ensure you're treated well at the border or for the next several years.
Oh, that ship has sailed, man. That ship is gone.
But I think you might be running into issues with respect to making false statements and obstruction of justice and various things like that. But you wouldn't have made a statement.
They would have prodded out of my phone, you know, at their own behest. I wouldn't have said a damn thing.
Yeah, I guess. But if you created the data with the intention of misleading the authorities, knowing that you were going to hand over your phone, then I think, you know, they'll find a way to shoehorn that into making some kind of false statement to the authorities. But it goes back to this issue of the testimonial aspect of a passcode. And a duress passcode is a correct passcode. You're not making any kind of false statement when you're handing that passcode over. It's a legitimate passcode. It's a credential to the phone. It just happens to wipe the keys that would allow anybody, including yourself or including law enforcement or including your mother-in-law, doesn't matter, to have access to the data that's encrypted on the drive.
I think what everybody should do is basically encrypt their data, put it in a very secure cloud instance somewhere, and then install Graphene OS on your phone, get on your plane, and give them the duress password each and every time. You're not losing anything except maybe your freedom, but they're getting super frustrated, and your data is safe in the cloud somewhere until you get out. So I'm sorry, that's the way we have to think. How do we install Graphene OS, just so people know? I know the address is graphene.org, and that's spelled graphene.org. And they have a really good page there. They have all kinds of explanations as to what it does, what it doesn't do. Rob?
And a couple of important details about Graphene OS. Well, for one thing, it'll only work on Google Pixel phones at present, though there are plans in the works for some devices forthcoming from Motorola.
Wait, you have to have a Google Pixel phone for this to work? I didn't know that.
Yep, it's tuned specifically to the hardware of the Google Pixel phone. The idea here is it's an open source project. It's a free thing. It costs nothing. It's also not a commercial entity. It's backed by a nonprofit from Canada, so it's not even an American product in terms of where the organization is. So in terms of keeping access to tools like Graphene OS alive and available, it's not within the jurisdiction of, say, United States Border Patrol or the United States, for that matter. It's a thing that exists. And, yeah, graphenos.org. There's interesting stuff on the history page if you want to learn more about the weird path this has taken to the product it is now. But it's just security hardened. It's not just about wiping your phone. It protects your your personal data. It protects your security. In ways that Stock Android will never do because of ways in which Google likes to monetize you. You can run Google Play apps, but only in a sort of special sandbox that prevents them phoning back home with all that much data. Individual apps can be blocked from your phone's microphone or camera or things like that. And it is just, it offers you so many ways to protect your personal privacy, your digital privacy. And it's a really fascinating thing to look into. If you weren't aware of these things, check it out, grapheneos.org.
All right. And, you know, we're going to have to leave it there, but you can write to us, oth@2600.com. And you can keep listening. At 8 o'clock, we'll be on YouTube, channel 2600. Next week, from 7 to 8, we'll be on WBAI taking your phone calls. We'll see you then. Have a good night.
Based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.